From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Hitler's second-in-command, Hermann Göring, said in the Third Reich, he explained the justification this way. During the Nuremberg trials, he said, "Voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That's easy. All you have to do is tell them they're being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and for exposing the country to a greater danger."
Today, journalist, author, and activist Helen Zia on the nature of evil and the politics of identity in the United States after 9/11.
The fact is, my ethnicity is Chinese, and now with this SARS virus, the arbiters of evil have just added another reason to round us up and quarantine us. And the joke in California is right now that if you look Chinese and you need a parking space, all you have to do is sneeze, and then you'll have all the parking you want.
But first, one of the first comprehensive investigative reports out of Iraq on depleted uranium. Christian Science Monitor reporter Scott Peterson has found high levels of radiation left by U.S. ammunition in Baghdad. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. By a 51-49 vote, the Senate last night narrowly approved a $350 billion 11-year tax cut package. It would become the third largest tax cut in history and comes at a time when the government faces its largest budget deficit ever. Included in the bill is the elimination of stockholder dividend taxes for the next 3 years. Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle criticized the move, saying, quote, "It's a starkly elitist tax break. The fortunate few will be able to shelter all their investment income while working Americans will continue to pay taxes and shoulder the obligations of our nation." The New York Times reports the tax cut will almost certainly exacerbate the government's rapidly deteriorating fiscal condition. The French government is charging it's the victim of, quote, organized campaign of disinformation from within the Bush administration designed to discredit it with allegations of complicity with Saddam Hussein. The French government is expected to deliver a letter today to the Bush administration outlining a series of false news stories. With anonymous administration officials as sources that appeared in the U.S. media over the past 9 months, cited reports of alleged French weapon sales to Iraq and last week's report that French officials in Syria issued French passports to escaping Iraqis being sought by the U.S. military. One French official said the stories that appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Washington Times are part of a, quote, ugly campaign to destroy the image of France. Federal Communications Commission Chair Michael Powell yesterday rejected a request from two of the FCC commissioners to delay a decision on overhauling the governing ownership rules of newspapers, TV, and radio stations. Powell had been asked to push back a June 2nd vote by a month to give them more time to study the issue. Although the vote is less than 3 weeks away, the FCC has still not released its precise proposal, but news reports indicate the changes would, among other things, allow a newspaper publisher to own a television station in the same city and permit broadcast networks to acquire more stations. Major media companies such as Murdoch, Murdoch's News Corporation and the Walt Disney Company have lobbied to lift the ownership rules. Michael Copps, one of the dissident FCC commissioners, said Powell's rushing to vote on proposals that could drastically change the media landscape. Copps and other critics say relaxed rules will lead to more mergers, leaving a few huge companies in control of what people see, hear, and read. In Iraq, U.S. forces raided a village near Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit before dawn yesterday and rounded up nearly 100 men. The effort is designed to show that troops will be more visible throughout the troubled Iraqi capital, where carjackings, thievery, and drive-by attacks on government facilities are impeding government reconstruction plans. The London Independent is reporting the death toll in Baghdad has reached 242 in just the past 3 weeks. In Washington, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld called security his, quote, number one priority in Iraq and said 15,000 more troops and hundreds of military police will soon be arriving in Baghdad. The Los Angeles Times is reporting that Philip Carroll, the former head of Shell Oil and Fluor Corporation, who is now overseeing the reconstruction of Iraq's oil industry, has admitted that he faces potential conflicts of interest because of his financial holdings in U.S. companies planning to bid on Iraqi oil contracts. Carroll continues to receive more than $1 million a year from Fluor in retirement benefits and bonuses. He also owns 1 million shares of the company's stock. Fluor has said it plans to bid on a U.S. Army Corps of Engineers contract to rebuild Iraq's oil industry. Israeli troops yesterday seized a Gaza town and killed five Palestinians, including three boys age 15 or under. This came on the 55th anniversary of the Nakba, or catastrophe, the term used by the Palestinians for their displacement during the 1948 creation of Israel. This news just in, the top Palestinian negotiator with Israel, Saeb Erekat, has resigned. Erekat has been a leading Palestinian negotiator with Israel for the past decade. Indonesian police have arrested five negotiators from the separatist Free Aceh movement in Aceh. The negotiators were trying to leave for talks in Tokyo, intended to save the faltering peace agreement. Senior officials from the Free Aceh movement have threatened to boycott the Tokyo talks if the delegates are not released. The Chinese government has threatened to execute or imprison for life anyone who tries to escape from SARS quarantine or to spread the disease intentionally. A truck driver by the name of Tyrone Williams has been charged in a federal Texas court in relation to the deaths of 18 undocumented immigrants who suffocated inside his trailer in Texas. Prosecutors said they may seek the death penalty in connection to the case if Williams is found to have caused the deaths intentionally. Williams lives in New York City. He's said to have told immigration agents that he was offered $5,000 to pick up 60 immigrants from a rural town near the Mexican border and drive them to Houston. The victims, many of them Mexicans, but some from Central America, appear to have died from suffocation and heat exhaustion. The New York Times has revealed that Republican state legislators in Texas relied on the Department of Homeland Security to track down the whereabouts of Democratic legislators. As we reported yesterday, 51 Democrats crossed the border from Texas into Oklahoma in an attempt to thwart a controversial Republican measure to redraw congressional district lines. The Republican redistricting plan for Texas could have important repercussions in Washington because it would almost certainly shift several congressional seats now held by Democrats to Republican control. The move was backed by the Congress Majority Leader Tom DeLay and George Bush's Karl Rove. We got married in a beaver.
Jackson Town. Let's go on down to Jackson. balls, Jack.
See if I can.
Well, when I breeze into that city, people gonna stoop and bow.
Jackson by Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash. June died yesterday at the age of 73. She was a member of the pioneering country music group, the Carter Family. You are listening to Democracy Now!, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. An article in yesterday's Christian Science Monitor begins like this. At a roadside produce stand on the outskirts of Baghdad, business is brisk for Latifa Khalaf Hamid. Iraqi drivers pull up and snap up fresh bunches of parsley, mint leaves, dill, and onion stalks. But Ms. Hamid's stand is just four paces away from a burnt-out Iraqi tank, destroyed by and contaminated with controversial American depleted uranium bullets. Local children play throughout the day on the tank, Hamid says, and on another one across the road. No one has warned the vendor in the faded, threadbare black gown to keep the toxic and radioactive dust off her produce. The children haven't been told not to play with the radioactive debris. They gather around as a Geiger counter carried by a visiting reporter starts singing when it nears a DU bullet fragment no bigger than a pencil eraser. It registers nearly 1,000 times normal background radiation levels on the digital readout. Those are the words of journalist Scott Peterson in yesterday's Christian Science Monitor. Scott reported extensively on the trail of toxic war debris. In 1999, he wrote a series of articles on the effect of DU bullets used in the first Gulf War and in the war in Kosovo. He joins us today from Moscow, recently back from Baghdad. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Scott Peterson.
Thank you.
Well, why don't you lay out what you found in Iraq?
Well, what we found in Iraq was we were able to confirm that there was quite a bit of depleted uranium weaponry that was used by American forces in Iraq. It's a bullet that's used by many different platforms. In other words, it's used as a tank round. It's used by Bradley fighting vehicles. It's also used by A-10 Warthog aircraft. The bullets that are used are made of depleted uranium, which is a very powerful, it's a very dense material. It's 1.7 times as dense as lead, and it makes a very effective penetrator when used to penetrate armor, which is why the Pentagon likes to use it so much. The only problem is that when it hits an armored target, that bullet then burns and releases a kind of an aerosol, it's an oxide, if you will, of depleted uranium, which is actually a toxic and radioactive substance. And it's the kind of thing, certainly, that if it had been in the United States, it never would have been permitted to be lying around, much less be contaminating such broad areas as it is in Iraq today.
Tell us where you traveled in Iraq.
Well, I went to several different places in Baghdad. A couple of tanks that were randomly chosen, the ones that you just described in reading the lead of my story explains pretty much where those two tanks were. But there are scores of tanks that have been destroyed in Baghdad. The majority of these, if not all, I would believe, would have been the subject to depleted uranium bullets, and therefore would have been contaminated to a degree. In this same way, but there were other locations as well that I visited. In one case, there were a group of four or five American ammunition trucks that had caught fire or been attacked by the Iraqis and had completely burned. And in this case, there were very, very high levels of depleted uranium contamination, to the point where American forces themselves had actually made some rudimentary cleanup, cleanup efforts. There was one other location in Baghdad that I visited because I knew that there would be depleted uranium residue there, and that was the planning ministry. I don't know if you remember, but in the final few days of the war against Iraq, there were television images of A-10 aircraft flying low over the Tigris River and shooting at the side of the planning ministry, and the A-10 uses primarily depleted uranium bullets, and so I thought that it would be a relatively safe bet to find DU there, and sure enough, there were no shortage of DU shells and casings there.
What do the U.S. soldiers understand now that they didn't understand during the Persian Gulf War? Is there any difference in knowledge about depleted uranium? Any warnings?
Well, I think that there's a lot more knowledge about depleted uranium, but the Pentagon's view ever since the first Gulf War is that really it is not a harm. It is not a danger to soldiers in the battlefield relative to other dangers that exist, such as being shot at with regular bullets, such as chemical weapons, and this kind of thing. Now, the Pentagon has every reason to downplay its risks because, one, they like to use it as a bullet, and two, because there are quite a few American Gulf War veterans that complain of Gulf War syndrome, and some of them say that depleted uranium was a contributing factor to their Gulf War syndrome. So if, in fact, a link were ever to be shown, then that would mean that the Pentagon would be hit with all kinds of liability suits and that sort of thing. So, but just to give you an indication about how the Pentagon attitude toward this substance has changed, in the mid-1990s, there was a multimedia training presentation that was put together by someone in the Pentagon on how to deal with depleted uranium contamination. And it really took quite a strong view in the sense that anyone who would come within 50 yards of a tank that had been hit by DU had to dress up in what they called MOP 4, which is basically an astronaut suit with a gas mask. In other words, no contact. You weren't to touch it with your skin. You weren't to inhale or ingest it. You weren't to have any contact with it whatsoever. These days, that training guidance has been very much eased to the point where now the Pentagon says that, these places should be avoided, and we certainly found troops that were avoiding very deliberately spots that they knew were contaminated with depleted uranium. And then on the other hand, if you did come into contact with such vehicles that it was sufficient to wear just a handkerchief or a surgical mask in order to prevent you're inhaling or ingesting these radioactive particles.
Mm-hmm. What do Iraqis understand about depleted uranium?
Well, Iraqis have a view that has been shaped very much by a decade of Iraqi government propaganda, which has basically accused American forces of poisoning all Iraqis in the south with depleted uranium fired during the first Gulf War. The Iraqis, in fact, blame depleted uranium for all the health problems. There are some very, very severe health problems, many birth defects, lots of cases of cancer and that kind of thing, which have emerged in the south. I have been down to that area. I've definitely reported on those cases, and there's no question that the health problems exist. They are very, very severe. But depleted uranium wasn't the only substance that was involved down in southern Iraq in terms of dangerous materials. I mean, for example, in the 1980s, there were a lot of people in the South that were subjected to chemical warfare attacks, or at least to chemical contamination during the Iran-Iraq War. Also in 1991, Saddam Hussein put down the uprising. In some cases, there was an uprising in the South, and he put it down using mustard gas and other chemicals. And as far as we know, chemical weapons and depleted uranium can have the same effect on the human body. I mean, for those who believe that depleted uranium can, over time, lead to cancer, this is also one of the results of kind of a broad chemical weapons exposure. So the Iraqis always blame depleted uranium for those health problems, and so many Iraqis believe that is what the result is when DU is used.
How has the Pentagon changed its policy, and what is it admitting as a result of your piece?
Well, I think that, I mean, the Pentagon has been changing their view. They seem to be, each conflict that goes by in which depleted uranium is used, the Pentagon seems to be coming closer and closer toward full disclosure. I mean, they themselves seem to be becoming more confident with their ability to say scientifically that depleted uranium has no effect on the human body, whereas they have also over time become much more open about the amount of depleted uranium that was used. I mean, for example, because they say that it is not a danger, they say that there's no real danger for it to be used on the battlefield.
But Scott, we have to. We have to leave it there. Scott Peterson, reporter with the Christian Science Monitor, recently back from Baghdad, speaking to us from Moscow. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. Laguerre from the movie Lumumba here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. We now spend the rest of the hour with Helen Zia, who is a journalist and political activist. Helen, an outspoken advocate for Asian American women and queer rights. At Princeton University, she helped found the Asian American Students Association. Zia later moved to Detroit and began to write on labor issues for local newspapers. In 1982, two unemployed white auto workers attacked a 27-year-old Chinese American named Vincent Chin with a baseball bat and beat him to death. The killers blamed the Japanese car makers for Detroit's problems in the auto industry. The two received 2 years probation. The Chinese American community was outraged, and Helen Zia helped to found an organization dedicated to achieving justice for Vincent Chin. Zia's work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the San Francisco Chronicle, the Detroit News. She's author of Asian American Dreams, The Emergence of an American People, and My Country Versus Me, The Story of Wen Ho Li. That book about the Chinese American nuclear scientist falsely accused of being a spy in China. He was a scientist at the Los Alamos National Labs and spent 9 months shackled in solitary confinement in New Mexico and forbidden to speak his own language. In the end, federal prosecutors dropped the charges against him, all but one, that of mishandling secret information. The judge who approved the agreement actually apologized for the U.S. government, saying it had, quote, embarrassed this entire nation and everyone who is a citizen of it. Helen Zia spoke this week in Long Island, New York, at Stony Brook University.
As we begin this dialogue tonight on the politics of war and remembrance, what I wanted to do was offer a few of my thoughts and observations from my wanderings through this American landscape of our various communities at this time of war against terrorism and all things evil. So I thought I would begin with a confession that ever since September 11th and the great unleashing of evil calling and evil naming against every manner of evil, I thought that I should share that I've concluded that I must be evil myself, too. And let me tell you what I mean. I've been making a mental list for myself. As Professor Dietrich said, I'm a feminist. I'm pro-choice. We know that that's definitely evil these days. I'm anti-war. That's evil. I happen to believe that government secrecy is a form of tyranny and that dissent is a vital part of democracy. And I'm betting that there are a few of you in this room who share these values too. And of course, that puts you firmly in the evil camp as well. Now, I am not Korean or Korean American, and so I'm not in that axis of evil. I'm a Chinese American, but to most non-Asians, we all look alike anyway, so I may as well be Korean. My name, Zia, is actually Chinese, a romanization from the Shanghainese dialect that means thank you in Chinese. But of course, Zia is a very common Pakistani name. That's evil, evil. And, you know, the fact is my ethnicity is Chinese, and now with this SARS virus, the arbiters of evil have just added another reason to round us up and quarantine us. And the joke in California is right now that if you look Chinese and you need a parking space, all you have to do is sneeze, and then you'll have it, all the parking you want. Oh, and there's that last straw. I'm a lesbian, I'm a queer person of color, and how much more evil can you be than that? But at least I know I'm in good company tonight, because the very fact that all of you would come to a symposium entitled Civil Liberties in the Time of War really makes us all evil right here. Now, as Lisa said in the introduction, I'm a second-generation Chinese-American. I was born and raised in the East Coast, actually in the much-maligned state of New Jersey. Oh, I know. I hear sympathy comments out there. But growing up in New Jersey in the 1950s and 1960s, I have to say I didn't have much of a Chinese or Asian-American community to connect to. And in this way, my experience is probably typical of many Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders here in Long Island, and basically all those who were not fortunate enough to grow up in places like Los Angeles or San Francisco or New York City or Hawaii. My community, the community in New Jersey I grew up with, was really a lot like the TV show Sopranos. And so the Italian Americans, Irish, Polish, Jewish, African Americans, Puerto Ricans, they were my community. And these days, now that I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, I truly do live in a pan-Asian and Pacific Islander presence, but I do get back in touch with my New Jersey roots by watching The Sopranos. And I have to say how incredibly enlightening it is to watch a show that's based on a terrible stereotype of Italian Americans, but then to see how the show actually makes these characters real human beings. It makes them appealing with feelings and personality. And it even talks about, occasionally, about issues facing Italians in America. And when I watch this show about my homies in New Jersey, I can't help but wonder, what will it take to have a network television show that allows Asian Americans and other marginalized groups to possess and display the full range of human emotion? And this is not an abstract question. It has concrete and serious consequences, especially in light of one of the themes of this symposium, with liberty and justice for all. Because, of course, we know when the Constitution was framed, the founders had a notion of we the people that was very small and very limited. Now, today, in theory, in law, we are all equal. But so the question then becomes, when will this concept really be reflected all throughout our institutions, including institutions like the media? Now, I have to say that I am a bit of a pessimist on this question. Not long ago, I attended a small conference that was intended to discuss the media and how it educates or doesn't educate people in covering international issues. And we all know they can do a lot better with this. And if we had to grade the job that the media does in international and foreign affairs, it would get an F-. But at this conference, the actor and playwright Anna Deavere Smith was present, and she gave a presentation talking about her work, and she performed one of the characters in her play about Crown Heights, New York, which I know is in the news currently. And the character she played at this conference was a Lubavitcher woman, an Orthodox Jewish woman. And so then there was question and answer, and I asked Anna Deavere Smith if she would comment on the difference for her of portraying the real full characters, multicultural, multiracial characters in her own plays versus the characters that she performs in commercial television on shows like Presidio Med. Now, I don't know if any of you ever saw Presidio Med. It had a very short lifespan. But for those of you who never saw it, Presidio Med was one of those doctor shows, okay? A doctor show similar to ER, Chicago Hope, and it was based in San Francisco, and Anna Deavere Smith was one of the doctors on the show. And if you can imagine a doctor show where one out of every four health workers, from the whole span of orderlies to doctors, one out of every four is Asian American in this country, and in San Francisco, almost half of the entire population of the city is Asian, and once again you have a doctor show based in San Francisco, a fantasy hospital with no Asians at all. And so I asked Ms. Smith what her thoughts were on that. And before she had a chance to reply, a prominent television producer actually stood up and he said, you know, the problem is that there just aren't any qualified Asian American actors to play a doctor on a television program. Now, this was really just a few months ago, and I have to tell you that many of the people who were in the audience, which the audience was actually a mostly non-Asian, roundly booed and hissed that comment by this television producer. But his words really did still stand out with all of its nakedness before us, as though the last few decades never happened, with all of the battles that the Asian American community have fought over the Broadway play Miss Saigon, movies like Year of the Dragon or Pearl Harbor, or the production of Flower Drum Song, and so on, and things like, it's as though things like this had never happened. And incidents like these, encounters like these, are really reminders of the schizophrenic parallel universes that Asian Americans and people of color must constantly traverse, even in this 21st century America. It's also deja vu, I think. It's like a time warp that every decade or so propels us back, you know, back to the 19th century, when congressional hearings then debated whether Asian Americans were too corrupt, too untrustworthy, too uncouth to be Americans. Only these days, the question is about campaign finance donations or about alleged espionage. And it was my personal disgust with that hysteria in the 1990s that motivated me to write Asian American Dreams. And so here we are today, in this time of war against evil. And within the Asian American community, it seems that yellow Asians are in, but brown Asians are out. We only have to remember that a few months before September 11th, China was the evil enemy of America. But right now, China is our pal in the war against evil. And I recently heard a State Department policy analyst say that America's relationship with China has changed in the sense that they see no foreseeable conflicts with China. And this apparent change of heart, though not announced in the Rose Garden, this apparent change in attitude toward China, however fleeting it may be, might cause Chinese Americans and other yellow East Asian Americans to think that they might be more acceptable as Americans today, post September 11th, than prior to that attack. And in fact, I've seen videos, a video documentary where a Vietnamese American man who came here as a refugee almost 30 years ago said that for the first time in his life, he now feels that he is acceptable as an American. Now, this journey of Americanness has really accelerated for some Asian Americans, like that particular Vietnamese American man. Yet at the same time, there are Indian, Pakistani, and other South Asian Americans who are daily subjected to abuse and harassment. They are physically attacked, even killed, for no reason other than their faces, no either reason other than their race, the fact that they are brown and somehow look Middle Eastern, whatever that is. There's even a case in Southern California where yellow Asian Americans, whose ancestry is from East Asia, have actually assaulted and attacked an Indian American man who was celebrating his birthday, a brown Asian American, all of this out of some perverse sense of being patriotic. These incidents are outrageous, and actually doubly so, because somehow people are not outraged about them. For instance, the case of the Indian American medical doctor who is a U.S. citizen and actually served in the U.S. Army with the rank of major, and he was hauled off a Delta Airlines flight in handcuffs for no reason whatsoever except that he looked Middle Eastern, and looked like he had, you know, that he had brown Asian skin. And for him, certainly being American carries a certain sting to it. I'm certain that his sting, the sting that he felt, must be very similar to the pain that Dr. Wenho Li, the nuclear scientist, felt after he spent a careful lifetime of not making waves at all, only to be snatched from that safe life that he thought he had built and placed into a terrible nightmare, a nightmare where he was accused of being a spy for the People's Republic of China, which he had only visited twice in his life for a total of 2 weeks. It was a nightmare that destroyed his career, wrecked his family, ruined his reputation, and totally disrupted life as he once knew it. All because he fit into a certain ethnic and racial profile, that he was of Chinese descent at a time when China was the evil enemy of America. As you know, I wrote Wenho Li's story with him, and I'm sure you'll remember how Wenho Li was accused of being a spy for China by unnamed sources to the New York Times, and then he was tried and convicted on the front pages of the New York Times, continually relying on more unnamed, high-ranking government sources. He was summarily fired from his job at Los Alamos National Labs after 20 years there, and every micro moment of his life was held under a microscope and examined, and then released to the media. He was imprisoned in solitary confinement, chained and shackled around his waist, his legs, and his wrists every day for 9 months, and placed under the most placed there for the most spurious kind of charges, until a federal judge, finally released him and apologized to him, saying that the treatment of you, Dr. Wenho Li, is an embarrassment and a shame to this nation. And why did the judge apologize to Wenho Li after this most extreme treatment of him in pre-Patriot Act 1 and 2 days, the most extreme treatment that any prisoner could have in the federal penitentiary system? This is before any kind of conviction, before any kind of trial. Well, the judge could no longer accept what the FBI had said on the record in court before him on why Wenho Li was so dangerous. What did the FBI say? The FBI said that Wenho Li, by merely saying hello or how's the weather, could impart secret coded messages out to somebody hearing who was receptive to his hello and how's the weather, and that in they hearing this would then get some valuable code that would help enable them complete a design for a miniature nuclear warhead, and then he would be able to incinerate 270 million Americans. This was the justification that the FBI used. They also said that black helicopters from China would travel across the Pacific and land on that, you know, 1 mile high mesa in the middle of New Mexico, land there. Ninjas would jump out of the helicopter, snatch Wenho Li up, take him, and it would fly back to China in this helicopter. And of course, ninjas aren't Chinese. They are a Japanese cultural warrior. But anyway, that's a minor point in a court where the FBI is talking. So the judge could no longer accept mere allegations like this. They had no evidence whatsoever, and the judge finally said that he could not keep Wenho Li in prison with these kind of accusations, and so he was released with an apology and now is trying to reassemble his shattered life. And in short, he became collateral damage in a much larger political drama that was played out with China as the evil empire. And today, looking back, you know, almost 2 years later, we can almost say, in some weird way, we can almost say that Wenho Li was a lucky guy, because he was released before September 11th. Because these days, we know that untold numbers of people, untold numbers of Americans are sitting in prison with unspecified charges against them. We don't know how many, we don't know what charges, they don't know what charges, they don't have attorneys who can represent them because they haven't had charges made against them, with all sitting there for more than a year now, right, in secrecy, with the vague accusation that they are threats to national security, the same charges that were leveled against Wen Houli. Only now they are imprisoned with the full sanction of our government, with the full sanction of Congress, thanks to Patriot Acts 1 and 2. And this is also done with the approval, or at least tacit acceptance, of the American people. After all, in Wen Houli's case, there really was a broad movement that formed to try to free him, as it was clear that these accusations against him were mere stereotypes and innuendo that was being thrown at him. There was a movement to free Wen Houli. And so today, we have to say, well, where's the outcry to get due process for these people who are being detained? We should all be demanding equal protection for these untold, unnamed individuals. And we should be asking ourselves, who's next?
Helen Zia is an author who's written the book America, My Country Versus Me, the story of Wen Houli. We'll be back with her in just a minute. If you want to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Back in a minute. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we return to a speech given by author and activist Helen Zia this past week at the State University of New York, Stony Brook in Long Island. Helen Zia is author of the book Asian American Dreams, The Emergence of an American People, which traces the history of Asians in America, and My Country Versus Me, the story of Wen Houli. Helen Zia.
I think the use of the terminology evil in a time of war really does come in very handy. History, we know, is replete with examples of this. And it's not hard to understand why politicians might find invoking evil to be a convenient way to rally the masses. After all, Hitler's second-in-command, Hermann Göring, said in the Third Reich, he explained the justification this way. During the Nuremberg trials, he said, "Voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That's easy. All you have to do is tell them they're being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and for exposing the country to a greater danger." It's something we've seen before. And in a way, the campaigns against evil are an American tradition, too, that came along with the Pilgrims, who, after all, did execute 20 people, mostly girls, in Salem, Massachusetts, for committing the evil of witchcraft. Hundreds of other people were accused back then, imprisoned, tortured for being evil. Now there are museums dedicated to them. But that was 300 years ago, and it is rather disconcerting today to see how evil has become a word that's so popularized in ordinary discourse by pundits, by journalists, in headlines on Newsweek and Time, evil on them. Instead of questioning the use of these words or these concepts that really are a form of American fundamentalism, after all, because we know that evil is a rather subjective kind of thing, and it's the ultimate simplicity to suggest that anything or anybody could be all evil or all good. Some of our Canadian neighbors pointed out that it's actually moronic to think that a civilized nation can long endure on such a path. Asian Americans in particular have been down this path of evil before. Whether we were being racially profiled as the Yellow Peril, or Fu Manchu, or the Japanese Menace, or the Red Fifth Column, and the evil alien enemy of the last several world wars that our country has waged. These are an inseparable part of our Asian American journeys. Asian Americans, I think, more than almost any other American community, knows what it means to be accused as a threat to national security. Long before Wen Ho Lee, 60 years ago during World War II, there were the Japanese American tomato farmers, okay? The tomato farmers who were seen as a threat to national security. They weren't nuclear physicists like Wen Ho Lee. So how do tomato farmers become such a threat that would justify rounding them up and putting them in prison? Well, what happened in the newspaper headlines during World War II were that these tomato farmers were actually able to raise their tomatoes, okay, tomato, in a way that their stems could all point in one direction. So newspaper headlines said, Japanese farmers plant crops pointing to US air bases. So should an enemy aircraft come into US airspace, they wouldn't need maps. All they would have to do is look down, and they should look for those fields where all the tomatoes are pointing to the air bases, and that would be their direction. And as ridiculous as it seems today, as ridiculous as it seems, people believed it. They were terrified. They believed it enough to think that, yes, we should round up 120,000 Japanese Americans and imprison them in American concentration camps. These are part of our American experience. And with the knowledge and the lessons that come from that experience also comes the responsibility to speak up about it. We can all take a lesson, I think, from the Japanese American community today, which has been at the forefront of speaking out about the daily incursions against civil liberties toward all Americans since this Patriot Act 1 and 2. And they shouldn't be the only ones. Every one of us who's able to see through this evil naming and evil calling really needs to find ways to have our voices heard. Now, there are, of course, obstacles to getting heard, and chief among them is the master narrative that of this nation that begins with the discovery by Europeans of a largely empty land where no other people existed, an empty land that was free for the taking and fulfillment of the manifest destiny. And there's a sort of unrelenting sameness to and uniformity to this master narrative, right? It's kind of like the master mall of America with the identical 40 chain stores in the mall, no matter where in America it is, no matter what part of the country you're in. And I know this well because New Jersey actually is where the first malls were originated. And just as we know when we go to the mall, we're not going to find a lot of color or character there. We know that the stories of people of color are going to be missing from this master narrative. Our stories are MIH. They're missing in history, as I call it in one of my books. And the challenge I see ahead for Asian American Pacific Islander communities is how to reclaim those stories, our very real and very American tales about our trials and tribulations and our contributions to this land that is our home. And certainly I think all of you here, students, scholars, community folks, all of you here at Stony Brook really have a tremendous role to play in sharing the different stories we have of our MIH heritages to challenge the sanitized master narratives that we know. Because until we succeed in this challenge, succeed with this challenge, we are going to find ourselves and other people who will continually be missing from the notion of liberty and justice for all. And there's a tremendous human cost for people to be missing from this concept. And I know, because it wasn't too long ago that I was this little Asian girl from New Jersey who didn't have a clue about my own history or the struggles of so many other Asian Americans before me. And my lack of knowledge really contributed to my growing up feeling quiet and invisible and being the silent little Asian girl. Of course, later I changed. But I have to say, back then, I could not even imagine. I couldn't imagine that in the 1800s that there were these Chinese in America, Chinese in New Jersey in the 1800s, who were toiling in the industrial laundries of New Jersey that serviced New York City. Or that I couldn't imagine that hundreds of Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders actually fought in the Civil War, wearing uniforms of blue and gray, mostly blue, but also gray. And they had names. They were young men in the 1860s, right, who had enlisted in the Civil War. They had names like Willie Brown from Canton, China, Robert Tahiti from Tahiti. And they came from places all across Asia and the Pacific Islands, places like Manila and Honolulu, Samoa and Ceylon, China, India, and Japan. They enlisted in seaport towns across the Americas, throughout the United States, in Philadelphia, New York, Boston, New Orleans, Richmond, Newport, places all over the United States of that time. And when you think about it, I mean, I couldn't imagine it then, and most people never think about this, but when you do think about it, it actually makes perfect sense, because much of colonial America was built on trade with Asia. After all, what was Columbus looking for? And the museums of this country are crammed with artifacts, artwork from the treasures from China, from Asia, from all over the Pacific. And it only makes sense that people from Asia and the Pacific came along with those souvenirs, maybe kidnapped as souvenirs or impressed into servitude as cabin boys or sailors to work on merchant ships. But while museums kept the artifacts and pay homage to those things, the people disappeared and their stories became MIH, missing in history. When I was doing research on the Filipino migrant workers who worked in the salmon canneries of Alaska, I went up to Alaska to go visit some of those canneries, and I went to a state-funded museum in Ketchikan where they had on display a machine from the 1800s and early 1900s. And what this machine did was it automated the process of taking the guts out of fish, beheading them, taking the guts out, and automated them. And the name of this machine, actually on the patent for the machine, was Iron Chink. So this machine was known as the Iron Chink, and it was given that name because the Chinese workers who came before the Filipino workers were so fast at doing what they did in gutting the fish that when they created this automated machine, they named it the Iron Chink because they thought it could work as fast as a bunch of Chinese workers. And so I suppose that this racial slur back then was in a way meant to be kind of a compliment in a way. But here in the 20th, then in the 20th century, now in the 21st century, this word Iron Chink labeling this picture stood there in this museum with no other explanation at all. So I thought, well, there should be a context. People who just, you know, come from Oshkosh should look at this and say Iron Chink and realize that it also is a racial slur. And so I went to some of the museum personnel and I suggested that they might offer a little explanation that could go along with this caption under this picture. They listened to me politely and looked at me as though I were talking about Mars. And so then I went home and I thought, okay, I'll follow up with a letter. I sent a letter off to the museum director. A couple months went by, a year went by, 2 years went by, and I just figured, okay, it landed in the circular file. But lo and behold, a little more than 2 years later, I get a letter from the state of Alaska. And somebody in their museum system wrote me back a very polite, sincere note saying that they would never want to say anything racist in their museum system. So what they were going to do was remove the picture and the display entirely. The only mention of Chinese or Asian people in the entire state of Alaska in their museum. And I thought just, well, how sadly typical, you know, that it was so much easier to eliminate the offending unpleasantry than to acknowledge what it actually represented. So the unintended consequence of my letter was to disappear these Asian Americans from the State Historical Museum. And I felt that there was a certain message here, a metaphor for where we are today in America, that people like us might be okay to include occasionally on TV, in the media, in museums, and perhaps in the academy, if only we go along with what the arbiters of what is good and acceptable and what is evil, if we go along with what they feel comfortable about what to say about us. And if we don't like it, then poof, gone, simply vanishing. Under the guise that, well, it's better for all of us that way. The thing is, we really don't have to accept this as the nexus between our past and our future. In fact, there's really no way we can turn back the clock to accept invisibility, the invisibility I knew when I was growing up as a kid in New Jersey. Our voices, your voices, really are critical to changing this notion that we or any other people can be used and manipulated to be invoked as the evil invader, as a threat to so-called real Americans. And looking toward the future, I've been thinking about how our 13 million Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, what our future might look like. And I think the tremendous challenge and opportunity before all of us today is really to anticipate, to imagine, to lead our communities, our dynamic communities, our American populations within our communities, and to really anticipate what this might mean, these multiracial, multiethnic communities we have, multicultural communities. And I have to say that I am certain of one thing, that the next generation of Americans will really need all of the voices, all of your voices to help envision a place in our American future, simply to show that we are all a real and integral part of this American tapestry. And this is simply so that next generations of Americans of all stripes won't have to search through shows like The Sopranos or Presidio Med in order to find some reflection of themselves or to reclaim what is missing from history. And it's so that each of us and every American can see how we are all interconnected in this quest for liberty and justice for all.
Helen Zia, the author of...
All do the same. Evil or not, we're all in this great journey together to bring what is real and true in our diverse communities together for the common good, and for the future of all of us on this planet in justice and in peace. And that is my wish for all of us here tonight. And I thank you for your kind attention. Good night.
Helen Zia, author of My Country Versus Me, The Story of Wen Ho Lee. Thank you very much for being with us. If you'd like to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. You can go to our newly launched website at www.democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Rybal and Vilka Tsouras. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer, with help from Rich Kim. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury.